Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi. You're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'll be speaking with Jessica Lynn Pearson about her fantastic new book called The Colonial Politics of Global Health, France and the United Nations in Postwar Africa. It was published last year by Harvard University Press. Pearson's book is an innovative and extremely interesting foray into the history of global governance. This is no small feat. The scale and dry bureaucratic language of international organizations have too often frustrated historians trying to piece together their past. The Colonial Politics of Global Health steers clear of these obstacles and tells a big but empirically rich story about the relationship between empires and international organizations. She shows how European empires resisted global health initiatives in the 1940s and 50s, and how that resistance continues to affect public health in sub-Saharan Africa to this day. The book would interest historians of empire, medicine and health, and international organizations. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Jessica Pearson about her fantastic book, The Colonial Politics of Global Health, France and the United Nations in Postwar Africa. Thank you so much for being on the show, Jessica.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I was deeply impressed by the book, and I'm really glad that we're getting a chance to talk about it today. Just to begin, how did you end up doing a PhD in history?
That's a really good question. So I've actually wanted to be a historian since I was eight.
Wow. Wow.
But when I was eight, I thought that a historian was someone who knew a lot about the Roman emperors and their wives and Roman architecture and went on the History Channel to talk about those things. So my life plan was that I was going to be someone who knew a lot about the Roman emperors and their wives, and that I would go on the History Channel and talk about those things. So I ended up going to a high school that didn't offer Latin. So I ended up taking Spanish, French, and German instead. And when I went to college, I went to Kalamazoo College in Michigan as an undergraduate. And I ended up double majoring in French literature and French history. I went on study abroad to France. And then I wrote my senior thesis about women in the French resistance. I was really thinking that I would do a PhD in the history of women and gender, and that was my plan. And then I applied to the Institute of French Studies at NYU to their master's program, just as sort of just on a whim. And when I was a senior in college, I got a telephone call from Herrick Chapman, who ended up being my dissertation advisor. And it was really because of that phone call that I decided to do the PhD in history and French studies at NYU. And that's really, I think, why I am a French historian today, was because of that call. So,
wow. I think you might hold the record for wanting to be a historian at the youngest age. That's amazing. So your book traces the transition from colonial health systems to global health, and you show how colonial powers fought this form of decolonization by trying to keep international organizations such as the UN and the World Health Organization out of their colonial territories. The book has an extremely tight thesis or set of theses that stem from really deep archival research. Like, how did you stumble upon this topic in the first place? Like, did you know that there was a story here before you got into any archives?
So I think when I started the project, I was thinking that I would be writing about, I think I made some assumptions about both public health in Africa and what international organizations do. And actually, for people that have studied international health organizations, they'll know this, but the very first international health meeting ever took place in Paris in 1851. And it was really about sort of harmonizing quarantine policies among different European countries. And it was sort of weird because actually there wasn't really an agreement among the scientific and medical communities about what caused disease at the time. And it was really a lot about international politics and, you know, the French kind of coming off the Second Empire, or sorry, the Second Republic, and really wanting to show that they could play along in the international system. And so sort of fast forwarding almost 100 years to the end of the Second World War, when I started thinking about what global health cooperation might look like after 1945 and what role the French might play in that cooperation, and especially the French Empire, I was really thinking that I would see the French playing a really critical role in building global health cooperation in Africa. And what I found actually was quite the opposite. So it was really sort of in doing like a deep dive into the archives that I realized, you know, what I expected to find, which was all kinds of cooperation happening in Africa being led by the French, wasn't what I found at all. And so this was sort of the, I like to do this thing with my students called history mysteries. And so this was kind of the history mystery that I wanted to unravel. Why wasn't the WHO more involved in building global health programs in Africa immediately after the Second World War? What did this have to do with the broader context of sort of the impending decolonization of Africa, and how sort of what role were the French playing in this?
And so you say that it was your time in the archives that kind of challenged your assumptions about the history of global health. Was there a particular document or a particular archive that was really transformative for your thinking on the subject?
That's a good question. I actually used a lot of different archives. I think what was most helpful for me was getting to see some of the internal correspondence at the diplomatic archives at La Courneuve, just outside of Paris. I think when you're looking at the official records of organizations like the UN or the World Health Organization, you're kind of seeing the, for the most part, the sort of final sanitized takeaway, as it were, from a particular meeting or a particular debate. And what was really illustrative for me was seeing all of the sort of back and forth that went on before these meetings happened. So just to give a couple examples, oftentimes before, so one of the committees that I study is called the, sort of in classic UN fashion, it's the UN Special Committee on Information Transmitted from Non-Self-Governing Territories. And this is essentially a committee that collects reports from the colonies on educational, economic, and social conditions. And whenever that committee would meet, the colonial representatives to the committee would have like a pre-meeting where they would strategize about what they really thought was going on. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of one of the kind of examples of the sort of back and forth before the like official UN meeting. And then, so this didn't make it into the book, but I wrote a separate article about the history of the World Health Organization in French North Africa. And one of the things that they were really worried about, so they really wanted Morocco and Tunisia to go to the World Health Organization and say that they thought that they were French. And in exchange for doing this, they said, we will propose you for associate membership of the WHO. So like, we're all getting something out of this. Like, we have people from our empire coming to an international organization and saying that they think of themselves as French. And then you're going to be able to be represented in some capacity at this organization. But one of the things that they were really worried about is that Moroccan and Tunisian doctors would go to Geneva, they would go to these World Health Organization meetings, and while they were there, there would be Egyptian doctors or Pakistani doctors or Indian doctors that would be trying to convince the Moroccans and Tunisians that they weren't really French. that they were either part of some kind of broader Arabic-speaking world or the Eastern Mediterranean region of the WHO. And so there was this whole extended back and forth in one of the years between various French officials about how were they going to make sure that the Moroccan and Tunisian representatives didn't talk to people from these other delegations. And so they were going back and forth with this whole list of like, you know, one day one of us can take the Moroccan representative on a picnic in the park. And then another day someone can take, you know, the doctor from Tunisia to the circus, like during the, you know, the downtime between the various meetings. And so just the sort of level of kind of planning of how they were going to navigate these different political situations. I think being able to get that glimpse in the archives of sort of how they were thinking about this was really helpful for me.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to take a step back before we go any further. So your book is about, you know, the 1940s and 50s, and it's really about, you know, decolonization and, you know, France's battle with these international organizations, which they thought, which the French thought were going to be, you know, vehicles for decolonization. But I just want to hear a little bit about why health and like public health mattered so much to sort of the imperial mindset. Why were the French so worried about health policies?
Yeah, so the answer to that, that's a really important question. The answer is sort of twofold. So the first part is that after 1945, the whole sort of rhetoric about the civilizing mission that we're here to civilize Africa more or less falls away. And it's essentially replaced by this discourse about the kinds of expertise that the French have to offer people who were colonial subjects and now after 1946 are now citizens of the French Union. And so this idea is that, you know, we're not here to civilize you anymore, but we're here because we have this particular expertise. And that could be expertise about, you know, structuring education. It could be expertise about how to build urban infrastructure. In this case, it was expertise about health. So that's the first part. And then the second part has to do with a really important distinction in the UN between two different kinds of colonial territories. So at the UN, there are a select number of territories that fall under the umbrella of UN trusteeship. So trusteeship is the successor to the League of Nations mandate system, which Susan Peterson writes about in her book, The Guardians. And essentially, those trust territories were territories that, at least in the African case, were former German colonies that were lost after the First World War. They became mandates. And then with the creation of the UN, they became UN trust territories. The UN could do two specific things with regard to those territories that they couldn't do for any other territories. And so in the case of Africa, we're talking about territories like Togo, Cameroon, Tanganyika, Southwest Africa, and Rwanda or Burundi. And the two things that they could do is they could hear petitions from people living in those territories. So there was a sort of direct line of communication. And the other thing they could do is they could send visiting missions to observe conditions on the ground. And this is eventually going to be part of this answer to the question of why health. So the UN couldn't send visiting missions to any other colonial territories in Africa, only to that sort of select group that were under the sort of administration of the UN Trusteeship Council. So there's really no way for the UN to get eyes on the ground in any other colonial territories. Now, when we're talking about the WHO, that's a different story. So I think one of the things that that people think when they think about what the WHO does is they think the WHO gives money to support health programs around the world. And while the WHO does give some money, especially after 1945, that wasn't the primary thing that the WHO was doing. The WHO really wanted to send experts to help develop health infrastructure around the world. And when the French are looking at this unfolding, they're thinking about, okay, so the UN can't send a visiting mission to Senegal or to the French Congo, but the WHO can send a visiting expert to teach a Senegalese person how to operate a DDT sprayer. And what they're thinking is that these health experts are going to potentially be sort of agents of anti-colonial activism on the ground. And so I think that's one of the reasons that they also get very hung up on this question of health.
Think about this a bit more. So the French are insisting on a very particular French expertise in matters of health pertaining to their territories. How does that expertise or philosophy of health differ from the idea of public health international organizations like the WHO?
Yeah, so I would say that this was, when I was writing the book, this is probably the question that I got asked the most. And I spent a long time thinking about this, about whether or not the French actually, in fact, had some kind of specific approach to public health that was different, or some way of thinking about this that set them apart from their colleagues in the World Health Organization. And I write about this in the last section of the epilogue. What I landed on in the very end, and this was the very last thing I wrote before I submitted the final book manuscript, but I don't actually think that they had a different view of public health or a different approach to public health than anyone else. I think that what's significant is that they thought they had a different approach to public health. And this is connected to this sort of 11th hour effort to hold on to the empire after 1945. Because if you think about it, if a Soviet or a Swedish technician can offer the same kind of expertise as a French doctor or public health official, and if what they're trying to do is to say that, the reason that the empire should keep going is because we have some kind of deep knowledge of how things work here, and we have some kind of expertise to offer that no one else can. Well, if all of a sudden, someone from a different country can offer that same kind of expertise, it really kind of undermines their argumentation for why they should get to hold on to the empire. So I think that that's why they're so wedded to this notion that the French have something really specific that they can offer in terms of health, because it's really connected to the way that they're continuing to justify colonial rule after 1945.
Hmm. You have a very particular reading of the UN Charter. So the UN Charter is riddled with bureaucratic language, but you think that within it, there was the potential for supporting decolonization. Can you say something a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's really important to note is that a lot of the scholars that have studied the UN and decolonization have come at it from the perspective of the British Empire. And I think that the British colonial officials felt much more kind of confident and secure in their position going into the deliberations in San Francisco that ultimately resulted in the UN Charter in 1945. But I think that the French felt much less confident in terms of the stability of their empire and their sort of geopolitical position more broadly. And I think they were a lot warier of the various loopholes that they saw in the Charter. So the Charter talks about a sacred trust vis-a-vis colonial territories and the kinds of responsibilities that colonial governments have to those territories. And I think for the British, I think that sort of vague language was in their minds a continuation of what they sort of felt they had with the League of Nations, which was an international organization that was fundamentally, as Susan Peterson has argued, going to preserve empire. And I think that really vague language about, a sacred trust and they're supposed to promote self-government. I think the French read into that a much wider range of possibilities in terms of what role the United Nations could potentially play in unraveling their colonial empire.
Mm-hmm. And you, the historian, do you think that the UN was a threat to empire?
I think given the broader range of participants, even in 1945, I think that the even from the outset, the UN had the possibility to pose a greater threat to empire than, say, the League of Nations when the League of Nations was created. I believe there were 50 nations that participated in the San Francisco conference and that signed onto the UN charter. So I think even thinking about that moment, even though you still have so many people in 1945 who are living under colonial rule, I think that there was definitely more of a potential for the UN to play an important role in decolonization. Mm-hmm.
That was a very loaded question, I will admit. So one of my favorite stories that you uncover in your book is how the World Health Organization set up a regional office in Brazzaville, which was the capital of French Equatorial Africa. And this was one of the most controversial decisions in the post-war moment in regards to global health. There was a lot of resistance to locating the office in the French territory. And so I just want to read a letter or an extract from a letter that you include in your book. It's from a colonial health official writing to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He writes, "It would not take long for Africa office to grow in size and to become a pole of attraction for all our African troublemakers, both political and medical. There they would find a ready audience, and the only possible outcome would be a decline in our own authority to the benefit of this international organization, whose critique of our sanitary project would be facilitated by multiple contacts with our malcontents." Can you contextualize this sentiment? Why was this colonial official so worried? And how, in spite of this initial French resistance, did Brazzaville get the office?
Yeah. That's a great quote. That was one of my, definitely my most helpful sources. I think sometimes when we're writing diplomatic history, it's easy to fall into the pitfall of talking about the French or the British, the Americans. Mm. And one of the things that, you know, as I, this began as my dissertation and obviously did a lot of work on revising it to publish it as a book. But over time, I think one of the things that, colleagues really pushed me on was to sort of problematize this notion of the French, right? Mm-hmm. Not all French officials or French people felt the same way about the role that the World Health Organization might play in Africa. And one of the most interesting divides that I saw was between French colonial officials who worked at the Ministry of Overseas France in Paris and the people that worked on the ground in Africa. So it was actually originally a Belgian proposal to put the office in Brazzaville. So the Belgians knew that because of human rights abuses in their empire, that the WHO was never going to set up shop in Leopoldville just across the river. And so they liked the idea of being able to sort of have access to this international institution. It might be good economically. It might be good politically. But they know that the WHO is never going to go for Leopoldville. So it's actually the Belgians that put Brazzaville up as a possible candidate. As you can imagine, the only member of the Africa region that is not controlled by a colonial government is Liberia. The Liberians don't want anything to do with any of the colonial capitals. They propose Monrovia as the headquarters. This goes back and forth for a really long time. What's really interesting about Brazzaville is that the colonial officials on the ground in the French Empire do not want the office in a French territory. They say, you know, put this office as far away from us as you can possibly get it. Put it in Monrovia. Put it in Kampala. We don't care where you put it. Like, just don't put it in one of our territories. And the French officials in Paris are thinking about this differently. They are sort of thinking along the lines of keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. So what ultimately ends up happening is that the officials in Paris went out and they decide that the best way to keep tabs on this organization that they see as potentially anti-colonial is to put it in one of their capitals. So either in Brazzaville or in Dakar. So they put it in Brazzaville. And once things get going, they immediately regret it. They realize they don't actually have a way to control this organization. While they can monitor what it's doing, they don't actually have the kind of control that they were thinking they would have. So I think this is a really important example of even within, the French, you have very different perspectives on how to approach these questions.
Mm-hmm. And so, just to finish off that story, so the office, is established in Brazzaville, and you write that it became a colonial public relations crisis of global proportions. Can you talk about this?
Yeah. So, I think one of the things that sometimes happens when you're writing a history is you become so immersed in your documents that you, you start to kind of absorb some of the perspectives of the people that you're reading.
It's dangerous.
It's very dangerous. And so I think, like, I kept reading all these documents about how great Brazzaville was. Like, the French really want to sort of put forth this notion that you have this, like, modern colonial metropolis and everything works great. There's, you know, great shops and a great cinema, a modern airport. You know, everybody gets along. You don't have segregation. And I think one of the things that was really helpful when I got the reader's reports from the two people that reviewed the manuscript was to kind of push me to think about, well, you know, what was Brazzaville actually like? And this is kind of connected to this idea of a kind of colonial public relations crisis. So Brazzaville was nothing like what the French kind of put forward when they're debating where they want to have the headquarters. It's extremely segregated. You've got people that are coming from Europe or the United States to sort of staff the office, and you've got white employees of the office going across the river to go out at night in Leopoldville. Not taking their African colleagues, of course, with them. And so the sort of reality of this kind of like post-racial utopia that the French were putting forward when they were deciding on the headquarters really didn't reflect the reality of what Brazzaville was like. And so I think, you know, they did actually end up inviting these international bureaucrats to kind of get set up on the ground. And they were actually able to get eyes on the ground into the realities of what life in the colonies was really like. And I think part of the reason that this was so problematic for the French was that after, and I mentioned this earlier, but after 1946, the whole idea of the French Empire is supposed to have kind of fallen away, and it's been replaced with this notion of the French Union. And on paper, Africans are supposed, everyone in the empire is supposed to have equal rights of movement, equal labor rights, the right to vote. And I think that the ability to see the persistent inequalities on the ground, that was what perpetuated this sort of colonial public relations crisis.
Mm-hmm. And it just also seems like they're just a whole gamut of problems from, they were complaining about lack of entertainment, lack of infrastructure. The housing was really problematic. And so it definitely revealed this French colonial project for what it was to an international audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So moving on, you work with a concept that you name intercolonial cooperation to describe the colonial powers, or one of the colonial powers' attempts to forestall decolonization in the post-World War II era. And you track how the French worked alongside the other European empires in technical and medical fields, so as to preempt calls for independence. This part of your book was super interesting, and I want to know more about it. So can you just share with listeners this looked like? Like, what did this cooperation look like? And why were colonial powers so keen to work together in this era? Perhaps you could tell the story of the Le Centre International de l'Enfance, or the CCTA, which is an acronym I can't remember.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that while the French and their other colonial colleagues from Britain or Belgium, I think while they're afraid of sort of international cooperation in the sense of like the UN or the World Health Organization, because that's when you're getting involved with these different delegations who may or may not you know, harbor anti-colonial sentiments is the, you know, how the French are thinking about them. I think that they did actually accept that there is some intrinsic value in cooperation, especially in the field of public health. Because if you think about diseases, diseases don't respect national boundaries, mm-hmm. right? And they don't respect, you know, boundaries between different colonial territories. And so I think that they see that there's some fundamental value in cooperating about issues of health. So they're the sort of two intercolonial efforts that I talk about in the book. The first one is the CCTA, which stands for the Commission for Technical Cooperation in Africa South of the Sahara, but it's generally referred to by its French acronym, so CCTA. And this was essentially an intercolonial development organization that would work on questions of health, questions of environment, things related to education. And it was essentially an effort to kind of preempt all of the various, UN organizations, UNICEF, UNESCO, World Health Organization. It was a way to be able to say, look, you know, we also believe in cooperation, but we're going to do it among the people that have this sort of deep, longstanding knowledge of the African continent. We don't need someone that doesn't have that knowledge coming in and telling us what to do. And then with the International Children's Center, the CIE, that was a sort of French attempt to preempt UNICEF involvement or too much UNICEF involvement. And actually, the CIE was a joint French and UNICEF venture. When UNICEF was founded, it was actually not intended to be a permanent organization. So the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, the emergency in this case, meaning sort of temporary post-World War II. And the French went to UNICEF, and this was under the leadership of Robert Debray, who was the father of later Prime Minister Michel Debray. And he went to UNICEF and he said, you know, I really envision a permanent international children's organization, but under French leadership, and I would like to sort of spearhead this effort. And actually, the International Children's Center was funded, I believe, 60% by UNICEF and 40% by the French government, and later that switched. And it was really an attempt to build children's health programs and things related to the development of the child throughout the world, but with a specific focus, at least in the beginning, on French territories in Africa.
Mm-hmm. So one of the more critical points of your book is that European colonial powers' resistance to global health initiatives were actually contributors, at least in part, to certain failures in the field of global health in the post-war era. And so you write that the pushback against internationalization shaped the landscape of public health as much as, if not more than, the international organizations themselves. Can you elaborate on this, this really interesting thesis? Do you have an example that that might illustrate what you're talking about here?
Yeah. So then this is actually a follow up to your earlier question about, you know, the office being set up in Brazzaville. So once the French realized that this is a mistake to have put the office in Brazzaville, they sort of shift gears, and the strategy becomes not, you know, do we decide if we put this headquarters here or not, but the strategy shifts to they essentially want to stop the WHO from doing anything. So they consistently vote against expanding the office, they essentially want, they sort of wanted to just be kind of a symbolic presence in Africa and not to really do a lot. One of the things that I think this most impacts is if you're thinking about things like the malaria eradication program, so MEP. Sub-Saharan Africa is obviously one of the regions of the world that is most impacted by malaria. And while there eventually are some pilot programs throughout Sub-Saharan Africa during the program, it's not really the first place that malaria eradication gets started. And eventually, if you look at what happens with malaria eradication, actually in a lot of places it is successful, but it ends up, the eradication part is a failure. But malaria is eliminated in you know, along the southeast coast of the United States, along the Mediterranean, and essentially it becomes concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that you can really trace this back to efforts to keep the WHO from doing anything. So one of the activities I have my students do in my public health in Africa course is we reenact the 1950 World Health Assembly. And the thing that I give them as a source is I give them, they have to each act out like a different delegation. So, you know, the Eastern Mediterranean, the European office. And I give them the little slice from the Director General's report. And so all the other delegations come up and talk about all of the programs they're doing. They're doing, various vaccination campaigns, campaigns related to water, campaigns against malaria, smallpox, eventually polio. And then you've got the Africa delegation. And I think every other group has this 15-page packet of all these things they're doing. And the African group comes up and, they have, two little pages of some, various minor projects that they're working on. And I think really this is a direct result of colonial efforts to keep the organization from really expanding its activities throughout the continent, throughout the course of the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just incredibly fascinating and very troubling. So, as we're moving to the end of your book, I just have a couple more questions. So first, you lay out the broader dimensions of decolonization. So, decolonization was a process that obviously affected the lives of colonized people, the people that were living in the colonies. But it also affected relations between empires and relations between former empires and former colonies. And so it's this latter relationship that I'd like to discuss. How did the UN and WHO affect the relationship or shape the relationship or enable the relationship between Europeans and Africans in the post the post-decolonization era?
That's a really interesting question. And I think what happens, so in sub-Saharan Africa, in terms of the French Empire, Guinea becomes independent first in 1958 after the French government has a referendum. Do you want to be part of France still? Circle yes or no. Everyone says yes, except Guinea says no. So Guinea becomes independent first in 1958. And then all the other colonies become independent in 1960. And actually, it's very interesting because the French actually stay part of the WHO Africa office through the 1960s. And I believe that this is because Réunion, the island, is in the Africa region, and it's still part of France today. And so I think that is how they maintain a foothold in the Africa office for another decade after the majority of the French Empire in Africa has decolonized. And the British also maintain some kind of a foothold in the office as well. And what's very interesting is that immediately after decolonization, this sort of intercolonial cooperation that they had put so much work into developing immediately unravels. And you start to see these really new, interesting relationships forged between the French and Francophone Africans. And actually, a lot of the battle is surrounding the language used in the WHO Africa office. So the French accuse the British and the Anglophone Africans of trying to colonize the WHO Africa office, and that's the language that they use. They say, we think that these people are trying to colonize the WHO Africa office, and we have to do something about it. So actually, the French government sends someone to go talk to various government officials in Francophone Africa to say, we don't think you realize how serious of a threat this is. And they talk about things like the various memos that are sent out from the office. And they say that they come out in a language that doesn't resemble anything near proper French. And that the French are essentially being marginalized from this organization that they say they helped build. And so I think what's really interesting is seeing kind of how those alliances really shift after 1960. And, in 1961, that sort of first initial meeting of the Africa region after independence, you know, you have this speech by the Malian delegate, and he says, you know, it's really great to see everybody here. I really hope that there are some faces that we don't see here next year. Meaning the French and the British. And then at the end of the meeting, you know, you see the same delegate, you know, shaking hands really warmly with the French delegation and, you know, expressing like a desire to continue working together. We'll see you here next year. And so it's very interesting to see how even over the course of that one sort of set of meetings that, this really does shift, from being a battle between people who wanted to hang on to empire and people who wanted to decolonize, to a battle between the sort of Francophone and Anglophone camps within the office.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I just have one more question about the book. So you're writing about a period that is, 60 to 70 years ago. So it's, it's several decades, but it's not too long ago. Can we see, in 2019, the legacies of some of these stories that you've told?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think if you think especially about the recent Ebola epidemic, I think that one of the things that journalists and global health officials immediately pointed to was the way that colonial governments underdeveloped African health systems, and they certainly did. But in my mind, that's really only part of what they did. So they not only underdeveloped healthcare in Africa, but they also, sort of at a time when the WHO was really getting, really hitting the ground running in other areas of the world, they really weren't doing that in Africa. So I think that the WHO also has this sort of long history of less involvement in a place that probably needed global health programming more than anywhere else in the world. So I think that we absolutely can sort of still feel the ramifications of that today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good place to leave the book. What is the next project that you're working on or considering starting to work on?
So I'm on sabbatical this year. So I'm actually working on a new book project right now. So the new book project is about the history of travel and decolonization, and the title is Traveling to the End of Empire.
Hmm.
And so this is going to be a global history of tourism and decolonization from 1945 to the present. And I spent some time this summer working in it's going to be a global history, so not just focused on France. I spent some time already working in the colonial archives in France last year, and then I was able to be in the British National Archives this summer. And then this semester, I've been in residence at the Library of Congress, and I've been reading a lot of really interesting travel guides and magazines and just all kinds of different sources engaging with the history of travel in places that were formerly colonized, but also in the former metropole, and thinking about how the process of decolonization really transformed travel. And sort of how I got into this was some of the comments from the reviewers were about, for the first book, were about, how do you make this diplomatic history come alive for readers when really you're writing about the history of people sitting in meetings. One of the things that I encountered when I was doing the first book was, you have these meeting transcripts and you're looking for sort of the drama, and you're trying to read between the lines. And sometimes I'd find these incredible doodles on the meeting agenda or on the transcripts. And I was thinking, okay, I'm looking for the drama. I'm looking for like the really interesting narrative, and I'm trying to read between the lines. But I think that what's happening is that, these health officials, government officials are sitting in these incredibly important but also incredibly boring meetings.
Yes.
How do you tell that story in a really engaging way? And so one of the suggestions that I got from I got two really incredibly helpful sets of feedback from the peer reviewers, and one of the things that was suggested was, think about people traveling to these places, right? Like, what would it be like for someone to travel to Brazzaville to go be part of the WHO office staff? And so I sort of like kind of puzzled through, okay, well, how would I do that? And so the very last source that I consulted before I submitted the final book manuscript was I went up to the Schomburg Center of the New York Public Library in Harlem, and I looked at some travel guides from the 1950s. And I looked at this travel guide that was about Brazzaville and Leopoldville, and I tried to get a sense from reading it, like, what would someone have experienced traveling here from the United States, from the Caribbean, from Europe, from other places in Africa? And I saw this photograph of some people kind of sitting in this airport cafe in Brazzaville, and the, you know, caption said something like, you know, travelers lounging about in the super modern, you know, airport cafe at the Mayamaya airport. And I found that photograph so fascinating. It was a kind of like a mixed group of people. So you had some people that looked European, some people that looked African, everyone looked very modern, you know, sitting there in their suits, smoking their cigarettes and drinking their espressos. And I really got this desire to sort of interrogate, well, like, you know, what was this really like for people? It, like, is this scene what all travelers experienced, or you know, what roadblocks were created or taken away with decolonization in terms of travel? And, you know, for the case of organizations like the World Health Organization or the CCTA, some people had to travel through places in Africa that were even more segregated than Brazzaville. So, you know, someone traveling from other parts of the empire, travelers of color passing through places like Kampala and not being able to find hotel accommodations as they traveled overnight. So this was sort of what led me to think more, wanting to think more deeply about the intersections between travel and tourism and decolonization.
Well, that is a book that I will be eagerly waiting to read. So that really sounds like a fantastic project. And Jess, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It was a real pleasure talking about your book, The Colonial Politics of Global Health.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I've been speaking with Jessica Lynn Pearson about her book, The Colonial Politics of Global Health, and you've been listening to New Books in History.